Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
The jury in the Enron case has reached a verdict. We're going to have much more on that in just a few minutes. But first, in a primetime news conference tonight, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair are expected to sidestep the thorny issue of when troops can return from Iraq. And the Senate is expected to approve a thorny issue of its own, immigration reform, but not without dissent over providing a path to citizenship for some immigrants. And perhaps the thorniest issue of all in Washington today is whether the FBI intentionally leaked the news that the investigation of Capitol Hill corruption has widened to include House Speaker Dennis Hastert, perhaps in retaliation for Hastert's very public outrage over the FBI's unprecedented raid of a Democratic congressman's office over the weekend. Well, joining us on the line from Capitol Hill is Boston Globe reporter Rick Klein. And Rick, this gets curiouser and curiouser. ABC News broke the Hastert story last night. What exactly did the network say?
The network said that that Speaker Hastert is, as they put it, in the mix of the investigation regarding Jack Abramoff. It should be noted that shortly thereafter, the Justice Department put out a pretty clear statement that Mr. Hastert is not under investigation, and Speaker Hastert actually, just in the last few minutes, sent a letter to ABC News demanding a retraction and now threatening legal action, calling it libel and defamation to publish information that they're saying they know to be false. ABC News, to date, still standing by the story.
Well, a chief of staff to Dennis Hastert says the leak directly concerns Hastert's links with, well, his outrage, actually, on the FBI's raid of Louisiana Democrat William Jefferson's office last Saturday. Let's remind ourselves, the FBI raided the office and took several documents, claimed that there was money hidden in a freezer. And we talked of this yesterday on Here and Now. Many people thought it was unusual that Hastert would step forward to criticize that raid on a Democrat because it did deflect, you know, it took the spotlight away from Republicans in the Abramoff scandal and cast it on a Democrat.
Yeah, there was a lot of questions about that. It was really an unexpected turn to see Hastert and Republican leaders joining with Democratic leaders and saying that this is an inappropriate search. But in terms of being unusual, this was the first time that's ever happened in the history of the United States that the executive branch executed a search warrant on an office that was occupied by someone in the legislative branch, someone in the Congress. So there's a lot of institutional prerogatives, but it certainly raised a lot of eyebrows to see why Speaker Hastert would be so outspoken in defending, in a sense, the actions of a Democratic member of Congress.
Of course, and he's saying it's a violation of separation of powers clause in the Constitution, but we understand some Republicans are backing off from that a little, saying it might make them look as if they're trying to provide special protection for one of their own.
Well, it's hard, I think, for the public to buy the argument that members of Congress are making here, that Republican leaders are making, and Democratic leaders are making, that somehow illegal activity would be protected under the Constitution, when everyone knows if there is illegal activity, you'd expect the FBI to be breaking down doors and taking computers and files and that sort of thing. So it does raise a lot of questions about whether there should be special treatment for a member of Congress, and it's a tough thing for the public to buy.
Right. And, Rick, we should say that probably all of Washington right now is buzzing about the Enron trial because the verdict has come in. We're going to have much more later in the program, but Ken Lay has been found guilty of all charges. Mr. Skilling has been found guilty of conspiracy and fraud, but not guilty of insider trading. As I said, we're going to have much more on that. But this would seem to take some of the spotlight away from tonight's press conference with President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair.
Well, certainly. I mean, the connections between Enron and the administration has been a lot made of that. Obviously, the president had a fairly close relationship with Ken Lay before he became president and shortly after becoming president, and it's become a hotter issue than ever with the record high gas prices we've seen recently. Tonight, I think the timing of the press conference suggests that the president and the prime minister wanted to reassure the public about Iraq, but I think you're right. A lot of this is going to be sort of pushed to the background in the light of the other big news that's breaking.
Yeah. Rick Klein covers Washington for the Boston Globe, and again, we'll have much more on the Enron verdicts later in the program. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, now we're going to take a few minutes to ponder what's going on in the housing market. Well, it depends on where that house in question is. Some mixed numbers came out this week. A Commerce Department report showed an unexpected increase in new home sales in April after a drop in sales over the winter, although this April was still lower than a year ago. But the Commerce Department and today a real estate trade group report sales of existing homes were down last month, and home prices posted their slowest increase in 4.5 years. Well, that's no surprise to anyone trying to sell a home in many parts of the country. The number of homes on the market in America reached a record high in April. So what's going on? Well, we're going to talk with some real estate agents about what their local markets are like in a moment. But first, we're joined by Nick Retsinas. He's director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. And Nick, here in Massachusetts, the Boston Globe did an extensive story about the glut of houses in some areas. Example, in one town, Shrewsbury, the number of homes for sale this year was 200, up more than 80% from last year. What does that suggest?
Well, there clearly is a growing inventory of homes, both new homes and existing homes. And what that tells me is the market is turning. It is turning from what has been, over the last several years, a seller's market into a buyer's market.
Well, I've had some personal experience with this, and I happen to know that in Manhasset on Long Island, there are 157 homes for sale today compared to 22 or so last year. Now, the real estate agent there said to me that this is because a lot of older people are passing or moving to smaller homes or nursing homes. So she's seen a blip sort of in the demographics. What are some of the factors that you see that would lend to this, you know, more homes for sale?
They have a word for that, you know.
What's that?
We are NORCs.
NORCs.
You know what a NORC is?
No.
It's a naturally occurring retirement community.
But no, I'm serious. Are you
you
serious?
Wake up. It's the house I live. It's the block I live on. When we moved there, we had all had children, and now all our children are gone, and we're all old.
And so it's just a turnover of neighborhoods.
Some of the homes that are for sale, particularly existing homes, my suspicion is some people are putting homes on the market because they're reading and listening to reports about the housing market. And they're concerned that they're going to be less able to sell that home in the future. So I think that's part of it. And part of it is the demand for home is slowing in part because of increasing interest rates.
It's so funny you say that you suspect that there are a lot of people are putting their homes on the market because they're hearing reports of higher interest rates and a slowing market. So it does, you know, it seems that in this case, reporting on this feeds into it.
Well, reporting always does that. People's perception always influences investment decisions. What people perceive to be the risk, what people perceive to be the return, influences buying decisions.
Well, since I'm trying to sell a house, goodbye. Stop talking about it right now. What areas of the country are strong? What aren't affected by this cyclical nature, and which ones are really being hardest hit?
Well, the ones that haven't increased, like in the middle of the country, they haven't increased with the veracity that we have on the two coasts, so therefore they have a much more moderate sort of cycle. But those areas, particularly the two coasts and some parts of the Southwest, that have seen double-digit price appreciation for the last 4 or 5 years, they are more susceptible to price correction.
Nick, what are some of the stories that you're hearing of people, you know, really trying to sell their homes? We read of a fellow who's offering a year's worth of gasoline, you know, to go with his house. I mean, what are people...
Well, you saw that, but you saw that. Didn't you see that, Robin, in the rental market here a couple years ago? You saw all the signs, you know, 1 month free, 2 months free, free cable TV. It's all trying to keep sort of prices high, so they're offering concessions. Another sign, again, of a slowing market.
Well, what about the unexpected increase in the sale of new homes as opposed to existing homes? Why would more people want to buy new homes?
Well, it was a one-month figure, and months can be very volatile, particularly in terms of new home sales. So I don't think that this temporary rise says that we are done with the slowing of the housing market. All the trends, increased inventory, higher interest rates, would lead us to believe that the housing market is slowing. There's a debate of whether it is flattening or bursting. I subscribe to the theory that it is flattening. So I think that is still the headwind.
We understand it's hitting other areas, and again, we're going to talk to real estate agents because of other factors. Michigan, for instance, obviously they're affected by the car industry.
By the economy, right. In that case, it's clearly the Michigan and Ohio are seeing an increasing rise, not only in inventory, but an alarming increase in foreclosures.
Well, speaking of foreclosures, how much of what's happening in the housing industry now has to do with the sale of mortgages to people who maybe shouldn't have gotten them?
Well, that has fueled demand. So it has increased demand, and because it's increased demand, it has an impact on prices. I think the real issue ahead of us is, as home sales slow and it's not as easy to put your house up for sale and sell it, that is, you're not getting a multiplicity of offers, an escape valve for people with difficult to service mortgages becomes closed. So I think we're on the verge of a pretty dramatic increase in delinquencies, defaults, and perhaps even foreclosures.
What's the effect of, you know, the housing market, even though it's uneven across the country? There's an overall effect. What is the overall effect on the economy?
It's been an important part of our economy. If you add all the different components of the housing market, not just new construction, but home improvement, the rents people pay, it probably now represents a higher percentage of our gross domestic product than manufacturing, which is just amazing. If you look at the jobs that have been created in the last 4 or 5 years in our economy, a significant percentage, somewhere over 40%, are related to housing. You couple that with the ease of home equity loans and refinancing, which is undergirded consumer spending, it's been a very important factor in keeping our economy moving.
Well, and what do you think is going to happen? I mean, some say that this is a bubble that should be bursting, that, you know, during the most recent boom, 2000 to 2005, people investing in homes as opposed to, you know, buying homes to live in them, driving up the prices, that this is a good thing, actually, if there's a glut and there's going to be a shakeout.
Well, I think a slowing of home prices is probably is a good thing. I don't see the bursting, and particularly in a place like Massachusetts, or more specifically the Boston metropolitan area, because we haven't overbuilt homes. And since we're not overbuilding, I think that probably creates a new floor, and it means that sort of home prices will not fall precipitously. There may be some exceptions. There may be sort of condominiums in certain communities, some multifamily homes that might be more at risk. But I think the basic bread and butter single-family detached home is probably not going to take a precipitous price fall.
Should someone who's, you know, caught in a glut in their neighborhood right now, should they just wait it out?
I think they might want to. They might want to revisit at this point in time. I mean, for most people, particularly in single-family homes, people buy them primarily for consumption. If they are owning a home primarily for investment, they're going to be likely to be disappointed in over the next 2, 3, sort of 4 years. What we suspect is that you're going to see home price increases in areas like this area of the country, in the Northeast, or particularly in the Massachusetts region, start to approach perhaps the rate of inflation. I think the days of double-digit price appreciation are now behind us.
Nick Ratzinas, director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Nick, thanks so much.
Nice to be with you.
And just ahead, the view of the real estate market from two agents, one in a hot market, the other. Well, wait till you hear the gimmicks that they're considering to try to sell houses. That's just ahead. And don't forget, just a little bit after that, we're going to have more on today's guilty verdicts in the Enron trial. That's all coming up, much more coming up here and now. Stay with us. The mixed picture of the nation's housing market. Overall, a glut of houses for sale in the U.S., but some areas of the country are hot, others are not. To hear some snapshots about what's happening, we've invited two realtors to join us. Paula DeCarbo Davis is a realtor with First Properties of the Carolinas in Charlotte. Susan Carter is a realtor with Woodwardside GMAC Real Estate in Royal Oaks, Michigan. And Susan, let's start with you. We've heard about this glut of available housing in some parts of the country, too many houses. What's it like in Michigan?
Well, I'm in a fairly unique county in Michigan. I'm in Oakland County, Michigan, one of the top five counties in the country in terms of consumer wealth and income. So So we have a very diverse market. In the north part of our county, we have a great deal of new construction, and we have a great many subdivisions with gently used homes. We also have tremendous inventory because our market is squarely situated north of Detroit and the heart of the American auto industry. So given the challenges the industry is facing, repositioning, regrouping, we simply have many people that have left the area. We have many, many new homes and used homes here in the south part of the county.
Give me a sense of that inventory. Do you have a sense of how many more homes you have sitting, hoping to be sold than you had, for instance, last year?
Well, we belong to two real estate boards, and I'd give it an intelligent guesstimate that new homes, we could potentially have as many as 50% more homes on the market, that is, newer homes.
Mm-hmm.
Used homes, probably about the same number.
Right. Well, we've heard people doing all kinds of things to try to sell their homes. We just mentioned someone who offered a year's worth of gas. Here in Massachusetts, people are also attending cookouts at homes where celebrity chefs are having open houses at some high-end homes. And I'm just wondering, what are some of the creative things that sellers are trying in your area?
It comes down to two things. We tell our clients, one, you have to improve your home or improve your price, because we have such a small pool of buyers in the market area that whatever creative tricks we use, cookouts, home tours, raffles, lottos, if you attend, six open houses in a given day, we're not getting any turnout. We're not getting realtors because they don't have buyers, and we're getting very few clients.
Well, what do you mean if people attend six open houses in a day?
We'll promote, 6, 10, 12 homes and have punch cards. And if people, realtors or potential purchasers, attend a minimum number, their name is put in a drawing for baseball tickets, golf, dinner out, a lot of options. Attracting that limited pool of buyers is probably the most challenging real estate situation I've encountered in 25 years as a realtor.
In fact, you were quoted in an article in The Area saying that sellers of entry-level homes are doing everything but hiring strippers to sell the house.
I said that last year in the Wall Street Journal, and I'm telling you, they may go one step further this year. I'm not sure what it's going to do, but
Susan, hold on a second, because
sure.
The picture is very different in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. Paula DeCarbo Davis is a realtor with First Properties of the Carolinas. And Paula, what are you seeing there?
I am feeling very lucky, actually, Robin. We have just a very, very healthy market here, probably because we are located centrally between the mountains and the beach. We have two interstates here, and this is about as far south as you can go and still experience seasons.
You did a little sales pitch there, I just realized.
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful. But we are lucky. My last couple of customers came from Connecticut, California, and New York, Long Island.
Well, we do know your area is one of the ones that people are moving to, and you're benefiting from that. We understand the North Carolina market sales are up 17%. That was in the first quarter of the year. Five straight years of record sales. So do you not have any glut at all?
We do not.
Huh.
Really do not. We have tons and tons of new construction here. In fact, very often there are waiting lists for new construction. New construction is king here.
Oh boy, Susan, listening to this, I'm sure you remember when there was an equal boom in Detroit.
I do remember fondly the days years ago when there was a point in my office when we would get a listing and it would be sold that day, and then we look back fondly.
Well, you both have different experiences. I want to ask you, are you seeing what we're hearing is an investor pullout of the market? You know, we know that people, and we just talked about this, people using real estate as sort of their, place of stocks, investing in homes instead of investing in other things, and now they're pulling out of the market because it's not worth that investment anymore. Are you seeing that reflected at all in either of your markets?
I'm not seeing it here at all. In fact, I would say the majority of the inquiries that I get on my particular website are for investment properties.
And that's in North Carolina.
Yes, but a lot of people are coming in, going into older neighborhoods, rehabbing and reselling.
Right, right. Well, we should say that we spoke to another realtor here in the Boston area. We spoke of how this area has a huge glut in several spots, one town, 80% more homes on the market than last year. But we spoke to a realtor who said the hot spots remain hot. For instance, there are towns everywhere, that Brookline, Massachusetts is an example here in the Boston area, that still are hot despite what's happening across the state. And what it sounds like you're saying, Susan, is that that's no longer true in Michigan.
It's no longer true, but some investors feel we have hit bottom. So only in the last, I'd say, 2 to 3 weeks have I started to see some people come into the market, people who are thinking that they may be able to buy now, get a fabulous price, rehab and flip when we rebound.
Yeah. And by the way, one last question, Paula. We're hearing that another impact on the market, at least on Long Island, where I've been selling a home, is the aging population moving out of bigger homes in the suburbs and maybe into nursing homes. But maybe, I'm wondering, down to you.
Yes, I think so. And we're also seeing an influx of folks from Florida, where they've been hit so severely by the storms, but they still want the coastal living.
Huh. So that's helping you out as well.
Absolutely.
Well, an interesting picture of the real estate market across the country. Susan and Paul, I want to thank you both.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
That's Susan Carter. She's a realtor with Woodwardside GMAC Real Estate in Royal Oaks, Michigan. Paula DeCarbo Davis is a realtor with First Properties of the Carolinas in Charlotte, North Carolina. And again, if you've just joined us, today's news, former Enron executives Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling convicted of conspiracy to commit securities and wire fraud. The verdict came today on the sixth day of deliberations following a trial that lasted nearly 4 months. The former corporate titans could face more than 200 years in prison. Sentencing is scheduled for September 11th. We'll have more in just a few minutes. And also later on the program, don't forget a visit with author Michael Cunningham. Much more coming up. Stay with us. More ahead here now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR.
The verdicts are in the Enron trial. After 5 days of deliberating, jurors in Houston have found Enron founder Ken Lay guilty of all six counts against him, including securities and wire fraud. And former CEO Jeffrey Skilling was found guilty of most of the 28 counts against him, excluding charges of insider trading. They were both accused of repeatedly lying to investors and employees about the company's financial health before it collapsed in 2001. And today's verdicts put the blame for the largest business scandal in U.S. history squarely on the men's shoulders. Jeffrey Skilling's attorney, Dan Petroselli, reacted moments after the verdict.
We had a trial. We obviously did not come out the way we had hoped. It doesn't change our view of what happened at Enron, and certainly doesn't change our view of Jeff Skilling's innocence. The jury saw it differently. That was their right. And we will take it from here and continue to fight the good fight. This is obviously a very, very difficult time for Mr. Skilling, his children, his family. There's a lot of thinking to do about the next steps that we take. But we're going to stand behind him. As I told him, we've just begun the fight.
Well, joining us to talk about the verdict and the trial is Tamar Frankel, professor of law at Boston University's Law School. And Tamar, I just want to ask you first, we just heard Jeffrey Skilling's attorney say, we're going to take it from here, take the steps that we can. Do they have an appeal? Are there steps that they take?
I'm not sure, but there's no doubt whether they have an appeal or not. But they are going to appeal, I think.
Sounds like it.
The one possibility, and the other is perhaps to come to some settlement with the prosecutors, but I really can't predict that.
Yeah, are you surprised by the verdicts?
Not really. I think the most important message that was quite clear is that the buck stops at the top of the management and at the top. That management cannot say, I didn't see anything, I didn't hear anything, I don't know anything, or the management cannot say, whatever we do or whatever we did is legitimate, even if it is glaringly not legitimate.
Well, part of the defense, the two men claim that most of the eight ex-Enron executives who cut plea deals and turned around and testified against their former bosses, Lay and Skilling, were admitting to crimes that they didn't commit just to cut the deals. And they also said that the these executives that spoke against their former bosses did so to gain lenient punishments. That didn't seem to wash with the jury.
Well, it didn't seem to wash with the jury. I was not there, but they were there. They saw the people and they heard them. And it came to the conclusion that the corruption was not with the government and neither with the witnesses.
Tamar Frankel, what does it say to you that this is the sixth day of deliberations? I don't know. I mean, to us it seemed short. How did it feel to you and what does it mean to you?
It means that the jury looked at the mounds of information that was placed before them in weeks of trial, and that the jury didn't kind of shoot from the hip, that they must have gone through the materials and must have deliberated. And so I take my hat off to them. I think they have done their job.
What might the, we still haven't had sentencing, and of course sentencing will happen at another time, we understand, in September. What might the sentencing be? We understand that it could be decades of years in jail for each of the men.
I think it could be, and the time when parole was very flexible and could be sometimes cut the sentence into two-thirds by two-thirds is no longer there. So the sentence may be very long, yes.
And money that they have to pay in penalties. Some have said, well, even if they do pay some penalties, if they ever get out of jail, they'll still have money. I mean, how is that going to be approached? Do you know?
I don't know how it would be approached. I know what I hope it would be approached. I think these gentlemen have to return the money they received, either in form of fines or in the form of accounting. And I hope that they, quite frankly, lose the power that they have. They can't occupy an office anymore. And let them be like everybody else. Let them go and work for a living under somebody else's management. And I hope that, I think, is the most important part of this whole saga. Let people know that if they have power of this sort, it's not their own. It was given to them in trust. Mm.
This is comes as we've seen other corporate trials, WorldCom, Martha Stewart. What does this particular trial say about the future of corporate fraud cases, do you think?
I think there will probably be many more settlements. But what I really hope is that corporate management will understand that the corporate culture and the corporate system is their responsibility, even though they may not know precisely what other people are doing in a very large corporation. And that is going to change America's culture and America's corporations. And that is what I'm hoping for.
Talking to Tamar Frankel, professor of law at Boston University here in the Boston area, about today's verdict from the jury in the Enron trial. Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling both charged with guilty and are facing decades in jail, millions of dollars in penalties. And just, Tamar, what do you think what the one thing was? And again, you are not in the minds of the jury, but what do you think the one thing was that led to those convictions?
Abuse of power. They felt, I think, if I were in the jury, and I think others too felt that here were people who had what the jury may consider everything, and they abused the power. I think that's what it was.
Again, Ken Lay, guilty of all six counts against him, including securities and wire fraud. CEO Jeffrey Skilling found guilty of most of the 28 counts against him, except charges of insider trading. A trial that lasted 16 weeks featured 54 witnesses for both sides after the collapse of a company that cost thousands of jobs, billions of dollars in losses. Tamar Frankel, professor of law at Boston University Law School, thanks very much for speaking to us about today's verdicts.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Here and Now. Now a little sports. In the National Hockey League playoffs, tonight could be the night for the Edmonton Oilers to make it to the Stanley Cup Finals. The Oilers trying to wrap up their series with the Anaheim Mighty Ducks. In the Western Conference Finals, they lead 3-0. In the East, the Buffalo Sabres have a 2-1 lead over the North Carolina Hurricanes in that best-of-7 contest. Oh, and there's conference finals in basketball and news in the world of soccer and college sports as well. So we've brought in Bill Littlefield, who else, host of Only a Game, to talk to us about all of it. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Robin.
And we haven't talked in a while about hockey.
And we have a great deal of company in that regard.
Now that the season is winding down, what is the verdict here, having just had another verdict? Have the fans been coming back to the sport? You know, it was such a long strike.
No, they have. The fans have been coming back to the sport in terms of numbers of fans passing through turnstiles in rinks where traditionally hockey is very popular. But they certainly have not been coming back to the sport in terms of turning it on and watching it on television, in part because many fans can't find it on their television.
What channel is it on?
I don't know, OTL, TOL, Outdoor Life. I don't know what the heck it is.
I always see them with ducks on the channel.
But it's fair to say that hockey has always been a niche sport, and that really hasn't changed. The strike didn't change it. We did talk to a reporter a while back in Edmonton, and apparently people in Edmonton are extremely excited and are watching in great numbers, and it's what they have there, so it's a big deal.
Well, the teams in the finals, Edmonton, Buffalo, Anaheim, North Carolina, I mean, these aren't the big broadcast cities, so that could be a problem, even if they were on broadcast.
Well, except that even when New York has been in the Stanley Cup Finals or L.A. or one of the other big city teams, the ratings haven't been very good.
Okay.
And I think it's interesting regarding the teams that are left that, like me, you can't say Anaheim Mighty Ducks without giggling a little.
I can't.
None of us can.
I still can't.
It's just the way it is.
Okay, on to basketball. There have been some exciting series already in the NBA playoffs. It looks like that might continue. Last night in the Western Conference, Phoenix beat Dallas in Dallas by just 3 points.
Well, first of all, exciting is an understatement in terms of the series just concluded. The Dallas-San Antonio series was terrific, absolutely great. Mm-hmm. I don't usually get too caught up in televised sports, but boy, a lot of that.
What'd you like?
Oh, they were wonderfully well matched. There was a sense throughout the series that each team was having to try to find a way to contain a new offensive weapon, and when somebody wasn't succeeding, somebody else would succeed. It was magnificent in the way that only a 7-game series can be magnificent. And the Detroit-Cleveland series was also great fun, except that, of course, the wrong team won, and we don't get to see LeBron James play anymore. That was the only problem there.
Well, all right. Duly noted. We have to, in the couple minutes we have to talk about soccer, because you are our number one soccer fan. And apparently, though, you're competing for that position with the president of Iran.
Well, yes, which is an interesting position to be in, I must say.
It's causing all sorts of difficulties because the World Cup is going to be played in Germany next month. Iran has qualified. And we read that Germany security forces are in a tizzy over the possibility that the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, might make an appearance to cheer on his team. He's played with his team. And they're going to be playing in Nuremberg, which is the site of the Nazi rallies.
Exactly. And, of course, he has said that he doesn't believe the Holocaust ever happened. One hopes that the president will keep his mouth shut, whatever he believes or doesn't believe, because the last thing that soccer needs is another scandal. We've got a terrible scandal unraveling in Italy as we speak, with all kinds of match fixing and referee choosing and inappropriate influence, and some of the biggest clubs in Italian soccer being implicated. So the last thing that we need in soccer in a World Cup year is this kind of hideous distraction.
And real quick, speaking of hideous distractions, you will see why I'm mentioning this. This weekend, the women's college lacrosse Final Four will be played here in Boston. The Duke women's team will be playing Northwestern in a semifinal tomorrow. Of course, Duke men's lacrosse team had their season canceled after allegations of rape. You know, people are going to be watching the women's team closely.
Yeah, and I more power to the women's team. I wish, again, that they weren't carrying the baggage that a culture of witlessness, at the very least, and perhaps criminal behavior has characterized the men's team there.
Right. Not their baggage. Carrying someone else's bags. Bill, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, touching down with sports. A ghost story set in industrial-era New York, a modern-day detective tale about suicide bombers in the Big Apple, and a sci-fi vision of New York City as a theme park. This is the triptych of Michael Cunningham's most recent work, Specimen Days, now out in paperback. Yes, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author used this three-part form before in his bestseller, The Hours, which was made into an Oscar-winning film, and in which women from three eras connected with Virginia Woolf. Now Cunningham's characters, all in New York, express themselves through the words of Walt Whitman. And author Michael Cunningham is here to tell us more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Why Walt Whitman?
Whitman was the great American poet and wrote about an America of 150 years ago, which was worthy of the praise he lavished on it. I was going to be writing about a much darker, more difficult America, and I felt that I needed to put Whitman in for the contrast, the nation that was versus the nation that is.
Whitman, I sing the body electric. Free associate with me some of the Whitman lines that we
think
of.
Yeah, every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. He was the least stupid optimist who ever lived. He was in love with America.
Well, so now we have your three stories. In the first, a Dickensian New York City in the industrial area. We have Lucas, a deformed 13-year-old in this sooty New York. His brother Simon is killed by factory machinery, so Lucas takes Simon's old job and tries to communicate with Simon's grieving fiancée by quoting Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
In the next story, Catherine, the fiancée, morphs into a black New York detective post-9/11 when a suicide bomber quotes Walt Whitman when he blows himself up and other people along with him. And then there's the final story set in the future, way in the future, when Simon now is an android who falls for Catherine, a lizard.
Mm-hmm. They're highly plotted tales.
They are.
I never intend to write another plot again as long as I live.
Well, what are you saying? Why? Why did you do this?
I love genres. And I believe that every generation ignores some of the great books that are right in front of it. The books we are ignoring now are the most feared and despised of all, science fiction.
Your readers in particular, fans of The Hours,
mm-hmm.
Virginia Woolf, mm-hmm. sort of romanticized a female storyline, and there suddenly you are with lizard ladies and science
fiction. Lizard ladies and interstellar travel, which, by the way, I just have to mention quickly. I just finished adapting the science fiction section for the movies. Julianne Moore, yes, will be playing a lizard woman from another planet.
How interesting they picked that section, because I fell in love with the first section, which was the industrial New York and the story of Lucas. He comes to a place with Catherine in a plot line that echoes the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, the real-life horrible fire.
Yeah.
I would love it if you could read a little bit. It's one in which Lucas and Catherine watch as a factory burns. It's the factory that Catherine works in. And, of course, we should say that in the real-life story of the Triangle Factory fire, these women were locked inside.
Yes, but yes. One of the things that was so incredibly horrific about that day is most of the women jumped from the 9th and 10th floor windows of this burning building. So Catherine and Lucas have seen a woman standing on a windowsill and her dress has caught fire and she jumps. The firewoman spread her wings and flew. Catherine screamed. She and the crowd made a single sound. The firewoman shrieked toward the earth, trailing ribbons of flame. Lucas pressed closer to Catherine's heart. His own heart, joining hers, swelled in his chest, grew bigger and bigger. He knew then that he was one of the dead, and always had been. He felt his heart burst like a peach breaking through its skin. He faltered, though he hadn't meant to. The pavement grew larger. Catherine caught him. She held him against one knee. Half prone, held by Catherine, he looked up. He saw the woman cross the sky. He saw above her, above the smoke and the sky, a glittering horse made of stars. He saw Catherine's face, pained and inspired. She spoke his name. He knew that his heart had stopped. He wanted to say, "I am large. I contain multitudes. I'm in the grass under your feet." He made as if to speak, but did not speak. In the sky, the great celestial horse turned its enormous head. An unspeakable beauty announced itself.
Why didn't you stay just with the story of Lucas and the shirt factory fire? Why not just a book on that time in New York history that not many people write about?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to reincarnate these characters in different stories, in different genres, and see their personal essences survive as their circumstances and their bodies and the times in which they lived altered. Mm. I've always been interested, as are many of us, in what is essential to us. If we believe in reincarnation, what is it about us that would be reincarnated?
Right. And the another thing that happens when you put that story right up against the next story, which is set just post 9/11, is that we can't help but think of the people leaping from the Twin Towers,
yeah,
and the people leaping from this Triangle Factory.
I suspect there may be no generation that's ever lived that was quite as conscious as we are of living in history, of living in times that are moving much too fast for us, and of living on the brink of an unfathomable future.
Well, Michael Cunningham, you mentioned that you have a movie now being made of the third book, the sci-fi book in this triptych, mm-hmm, of Specimen Days, and you have a collection of Whitman's writings being re-released with the paperback version of Specimen Days. You also have the band The Scissor Sisters recording a song for a new album, and that song is based on Specimen Days.
Yeah.
It would all seem good, but Publishers Weekly says that, you know, this book, which was released in hardcover just recently, didn't do as well, and this is an attempt to sort of bring it back to the public with maybe something more palatable, like a book of Walt Whitman to go along with it. Do you think that there's maybe too much in here for the average reader, you know, three books in one?
Oh, I don't know who the average reader is, and if such a person exists, I certainly don't write for that person. I write for people who are at least a little bit smarter than I am. The reason we published a selection of Whitman's poetry at the same time we put out the paperback is that I found myself reading from Specimen Days and being asked over and over again by people who hadn't read Whitman, what should I read? And the answer is you should read not one but two different editions of this mammoth poem that he spent his entire life writing and rewriting, Specimen Days, which he in many ways improved over time, in many ways diluted over time. We agreed, Picador and I, my paperback publisher and I, agreed that it would be a good thing to give people a sort of... Just slap me if I say Whitman sampler, but okay. it's a sort of entry into Whitman.
Sure, because even if you knew Whitman at one time, as we're reading this book, and I'm reading Lucas, who compulsively just speaks out Whitman lines. He just can't stop himself.
In a Tourette's-like way, yeah.
He does. He says, I know I am deathless. I know this orbit of mine cannot be swept by a carpenter's compass.
Mm-hmm.
Or later, and now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. You find yourself thinking, yeah, what's that from?
Yeah.
Even if you know it.
Yeah, and maybe you don't have a year to spare in which to read Leaves of Grass in its entirety.
Yeah. Writer Michael Cunningham's book Specimen Days is now out in paperback. Also being released right now, his selected excerpts of Whitman's poetry and prose. It's called Laws for Creation, another line from Walt Whitman. Michael Cunningham, thanks so much for coming to speak with us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the new